Alan McCrae, lecturer on Isaiah, chapters 1 through 6. This is lecture number 5. And here, then, it is possible that the Messiah is also the branch that comes from the Lord, and is also the fruit that comes from the earth. The adjectives used with the second part of it are just as strong as the adjectives used in the first part of it. And we find that whether Isaiah understood this or not, he suggested the same thing where he said, quote, "Unto us a son is born, unto us a son is given," end quote. Now, that could simply be Hebrew parallelism. But the fact is that we have two terms used by Isaiah. One is born, the other is given. It is reasonable to consider these terms as suggesting the twofold nature of Christ. He is the second person of the Trinity. He is God incarnate in human flesh. He is the branch of the Lord, but he is also man. He had a human heritage, a human background, a human lineage. He is the fruit of the earth as well as being the branch of the Lord. And so it seems to me that it is altogether reasonable to consider that we have the two aspects of Christ here predicted by Isaiah. I mention here Romans chapter 1, verses 3 to 4, because the Apostle Paul brought out those two aspects so clearly there, though it is only done so in many other places in the New Testament as well. I will just read the King James Version of these two verses in Romans, verses 3 and 4. Quote, "Concerning his Son, Jesus Christ our Lord, who was made according to the seed of David, according to the flesh, and declared to be the Son of God, with power according to the Spirit of holiness," end quote. Here we have the two aspects of the person of Christ, and so I believe we are justified in saying that we have them here in this verse of Isaiah. Now we go on to capital B, which is, quote, "the divine provision for holiness," end quote, and that is unquestionably what is contained in Isaiah chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. This point, I might switch back to the passage I read previously, that is verses 3 and 4, quote, "And it shall come to pass that he is left in Zion, and he that remains in Jerusalem shall be called holy. Every one that is written among the living in Jerusalem, when the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion," end quote. Do you notice the daughters of Zion can make up what proceeds, but it does not necessarily mean it is the same person? There is a contrast between those who are punished for their sins and those who are purged by the Lord, cleansed from their sins, that is. And this cleansing ties right up here with their finding their joy and satisfaction through the branch of the Lord and the fruit of the earth. Quote, "He that is left in Zion and that remains in Jerusalem shall be called holy, even every one that is written among the living in Jerusalem, when the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning," end quote. One could take this simply as meaning that through the attacks of the enemy, through the great catastrophes that are going through, they are going to be purged and cleansed. All the who are left will be cleansed of their filth and will be finding their joy in the branch of the Lord and the fruit of the earth. But one can equally say that it is looking forward to a later period contrasted with this earlier period. Contrasted with the sin of Isaiah's day, there is to be a time when the Messiah, the one who is both God and man, will be the one who is wonderful and glorious, and that will be a time when the Lord will have washed away the filth of his people and purged the blood of Jerusalem by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning. It does not explicitly and clearly refer to Christ's atonement, but it certainly can be considered as such, for we certainly have no real cleansing at any time except in relation to what Christ's atonement has done. So we have in these two verses the divine provisions for holiness. Then, capital C, quote, divine protection and leadership for God's children, end quote. I repeat the title again, divine protection and leadership for God's children. There is quite a bit put into that title, and there are some things very definitely left out of it as well. Divine protection and leadership for God's children. We look at verses 5 to 6, quote, the Lord will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion and upon her assembly, end quote. Now this word, assembly, is a word that does not apply to something that is permanent. It is more something that is temporary, people coming together upon her assembly. Quote, a cloud and smoke by day, and the shining of a flaming fire by night, end quote. Anyone in Isaiah's day, or as a matter of fact, anyone familiar with the Bible today, reading those phrases immediately thinks of the pilgrimage journey of the Israelites as they came from Egypt after being delivered from Egypt and going through the experience of the Passover there as they were coming towards the promised land, how God puts over them a cloud of smoke by day and a flaming fire by night to guide them and to protect them. Remember, when they came to the Red Sea, the Lord caused it to part. He had a pillar of fire for them that should give them light, and the cloud that should hide them from the Egyptian forces who had followed them and were intending to destroy them. It gave them both leadership and protection. And so here we have a reference back to the Exodus, to the pilgrimage journey of the Israelites, when God led and protected them. And it is stated that there will be a similar protection for them, a similar leading for them, stated as, quote, and upon all the glory shall be a defense, end quote. I don't know why the King James Version uses the word defense at this particular place. The word is only translated defense once in the King James Version. It is translated chamber once and closet once. It is derived from a verb which would seem to me that which closes something in and protects it. It is translated canopy in the New American Standard Bible Version, and it is a word that seems to suggest a sort of a temporary type of protection. And that idea is still further drawn out in the next verse, quote, there shall be a tabernacle for a shelter, end quote. Now this word, tabernacle, in the Bible doesn't mean something put up to hold evangelistic services. The word tabernacle does not necessarily in itself imply a religious significance, but it does have the significance of something temporary. Very often in the Old Testament, the King James Version uses the word tabernacle to translate the word, the Hebrew word, ohel, which means a tent. But in this case, it is not that word, but the Hebrew word sukkah, which means a booth. It is used where Jonah put up a little structure to protect himself from the sun. It is used in the Feast of Booths. It is the feast in which it is also called the Feast of Tabernacles. It is a time when among modern Jews, they often, in their backyards, put up a little temporary thing of branches and leaves to remind them of the wilderness journey and the way God protected them as they went through the desert. It is a temporary place, not a permanent place of living. There will be a booth for a shadow in the daytime from the heat, and for a place of refuge, and for a cover from storm and from rain. Here is the divine leadership and divine protection of people thought of as pilgrims, that is, God's people who are thought of as pilgrims, but people who have been cleansed through the one who is both God and man. These people are here protected from the dangers that are round about them. They are protected from the storm, from the rain, from the heat, and from the sun. It is quite different from chapter 2. I asked you in the assignment from last time what verses in this chapter, that is chapter 4, show the removal of external danger, and in this chapter I do not find anything that shows the removal of external danger, such as we had in chapter 2. That is the clear emphasis of chapter 2. It is to be a period of complete removal of external danger. God has promised that we can look forward to it, and now it is going to come. But chapter 4, we have something different. We have dangers round about. We do not have a permanent dwelling. We have temporary abodes, but we have God's protection and God's leadership to those who have been cleansed by, quote, the spirit of burning and the spirit of judgment, end quote. And so it would seem to me, one must say that verses 4 to 6 cannot look forward. Let's say verses 3 to 6, if you like, cannot look forward to the millennium, but must look forward to a time when God's people are being particularly protected by Him. A time when these people have been cleansed by the spirit of burning and the spirit of judgment. If we have only verses 3 to 6, we might very well say that this reverses God's protection of Israel at some time during this history subsequent to the time of Isaiah. In the view of the fact that it is so closely connected with verse 2, which predicts the glory of the one who is both, quote, branch of the Lord and fruit of the earth, end quote, it would seem to me to be still more reasonable to say that it looks forward to those who find in him their glory and satisfaction, that it looks forward to them as they carry on their earthly journey in the midst of danger, of persecution, of difficulty and trouble, that God will give them guidance, leadership, and protection, whatever comes, just as he did for the Israelites as they went through the wilderness. Now, as between these two interpretations, I would not wish to be dogmatic. If we did not have verse 2, if we only had verses 3 to 6, I would say that I could not decide between the two. I would not know which of these three interpretations might be right. In view of verse 2, it seems to me it is hard to escape the conclusion, as Peter said, quote, they are looking forward to the Christ and to the glory that should follow, end quote, and that he is looking forward to the complete glory of the millennium, or the period that follows the millennium, or looking forward to the time of the pilgrim journey of each believer. So I think that at this point we can go on to chapter 5, and in chapter 5 it seems to me the most important thing as we approach the chapter is to note that there is an important division in this chapter. First, the general subject of the whole chapter is rebuke for sin and declaring of coming punishment. That is the theme of the chapter as a whole. Nevertheless, it is true that the first 7 verses deal with one specific parable or picture. And this picture is not referred to again in the chapter. There is no further reference to the Lord's vineyard or to the Lord's treatment of sins. So while the whole chapter is dealing with God's condemnation of sin, of his people, verses 1 to 7 form a definite unit by themselves. I must say I was disappointed to find that some in the class who did the assignment divided these 7 verses into 2 or 3 or even 4 parts, when in reality they are one. It seems to me the real division is between verses 7 and 8. 1 to 7 forms a complete unit. There is no break in these verses. Now, that being the case, let's go to verse 8. From verse 8 on, the direction I have suggested to you in looking at all the prophetic books is to realize that we are dealing with rebuke and with blessing for God's people. I think that the greater part of the prophetic books falls on one of those two headings, either rebuke or blessing. And all of this falls under the head of rebuke, that is, all of this in chapter 5, verse 8 and on. But under the subject of rebuke, we have material that deals particularly with pointing out and pointing to sin and declaring God's unhappiness with the sin of the people, his rebuke for their sin, and urging people to turn away from it. And we have passages in which he specifically predicts punishment for sin. Now, in this chapter, chapter 5, the last part is very definitely dealing with punishment for sin. Let's look at verses 24 to 30. They are entirely dealing with punishment of sin. The fact that verse 25 ends with a phrase that is used as the end of several stanzas of a poem later in the book of Isaiah leads some people easily to think that there is an important break after verse 25. But actually, the subject matter of verse 25 and that of the verses that follow are very closely related. From 24 on through to the end of the chapter, he is telling what God is going to cause. And there shall be great misery to come on the land, when a fierce people, fierce and wildly aggressive people, will attack with a tremendous roaring like a lion and roar against the people of Judah like the roaring of the sea. And if you look to the land, you behold darkness. So there is punishment from verse 24 on. But in the part from verse 8 to 23, you have largely rebuked sin. You also have certain verses that deal with punishment. Verses 9 to 10, for instance. 9 and 10 coming after telling them in verse 8 about the wrongness of covetousness and selfishness and trying to build up tremendous estates for themselves. He then goes on to say that many houses will become desolate, without inhabitants, and that the land will produce very, very little. This is definite punishment. Then Isaiah goes on with various types of sin, then rebuke, and then, in verses 13 to 17, again you have punishment for their sins. Quote, "Therefore my people are gone into captivity," end quote, he writes. Does this describe what happened in Isaiah's day, when many people were taken via Damascus by Sennacherib into captivity, into Assyria? Or does it look forward to the future days, when the whole nation would go into captivity? We cannot say. Of course, in English, we translate this passage differently depending upon which way we understand it. We don't know for sure how the author meant it. He may have been looking forward to the Assyrian conquest, but he also may have been looking to later conquests and attacks. Some commentators think this passage does not refer to the Assyrian conquest. Note the phrase, quote, "many nations," but I would say the Assyrians had conquered many nations and had their forces made up of people from many nations. So it could conceivably be a reference to the Assyrian conquest. It could, however, refer to the Babylonian conquest. It could refer to the Persian conquest, or to the coming of the Hellenistic Empire, or the Roman Empire, which was made up of people from many nations under Roman control. There is no conclusive proof that one would be wrong to say that the last few verses of the chapter were pointed even beyond the Roman Empire to a terrible catastrophe for Israel towards the end of the age. That is not impossible, but there's nothing in the passage that requires it. It could point forward to matters that have already happened. Some of these woes in this chapter against particular sins, I think, are very appropriate to our day. Look at verse 20. Quote, "Woe to them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter," end quote. What a picture of the relativity of the present day when people use words in the exact opposite sense in which they are usually taken. Well, I look at the clock. I see it's time to quit. I've just mentioned that this first parable of the Lord's vineyard in the first part of chapter 5 is the background of the parable that our Lord gave in the New Testament, which is quoted in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and therefore of special interest. Next time, the first half hour, we will have a little test on what we have done thus far, and then we will continue. I will see you then.